What's the source of wisdom? How can you live a more conscious life? Sometimes it's the questions that bring you your own quantum leaps. Wisdom Talk Radio brings you conversations with visionary thinkers, business mentors, and provocative authors and teachers, along with resources that point the way for you to claim your potential in service to the world. Join Laurie Seymour at Wisdom Talk Radio for explorations in conscious living. Subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcast or find us at Wisdom Talk Radio on Facebook.
Welcome back to the Sensitivity Doctors, everyone. We are so excited to have you here today to hear one of the people that I have purely admired, her work, Jessica Baum. She is an author of Anxiously Attached, Becoming More Secure in Life, Love, and the founder of Be Self Full. She just has so many amazing things she puts out into the world about attachment patterns. And you learned some really cool things on this episode about your family.
Yeah. And also about my own attachment styles and patterns. And I think I said this is the first time I ever understood my dad. So it was a really cool episode. She's so knowledgeable. She explains it in such a relatable way. And I mean, some of our listeners may have read her book, Anxiously Attached. So if you're also a fan, this is definitely the episode for you.
Absolutely. And we didn't even just stop there. I feel like she was so willing to answer all of our questions about our own relationships, about questions my clients have had. So for those of you who were curious about how to become more securely attached or how to, you know, work through the way your nervous system reacts to other people, how to find more anchors of secure attachment. I mean, she just had so many great ideas. So I'm so excited for you guys to listen and to also hear about her upcoming book that she's been working on too. Yeah. So stay tuned, everyone. Jessica, I am super excited to talk to you. I feel like I've gotten to know you like virtually through your work, and so many of my clients are actually excited to listen to this episode too, because they're all anxiously attached fans of your book. So thank you so much for taking the time and being with us here today.
Yeah, I am grateful for our relationship. I see you kind of supporting me and I see you out there, and I was happy to come online today and have this conversation with you. And yeah, hopefully it helps all your viewers and your personal clients. That's awesome.
Yes. Yes. And you know, we find sometimes in these conversations, we get helped as well. So I'm excited to dive in. So I was curious, you know, what got you initially interested in exploring anxious attachment and wanting to write it and about it? What inspired your book? And if you want to mention a little bit about your first book, because I know you're working on another one.
Well, I mean, I share a little in the introduction of my book how much I've suffered from my own attachment wounds and patterns. So there, you know, obviously there's my own suffering led me to curiosity around, you know, why am I suffering in relationships this way? And then in my practice, I studied Imago therapy, which is couples counseling. And I really started to dive into the dynamics and the patterns of the anxious avoiding dance and all types of couples, and they were coming to me. And then couple that with, I worked in the addiction field for a while and I treated family systems. So I was, you know, I was really like systems treating. So I was learning all this stuff and I was like, wow, I'm experiencing this stuff in my personal life. I was getting personal therapy. And then I started helping people through their core wounds and their attachment patterns. And I started to see what was working. And I started to notice that like so many people suffer in the same way I had suffered. And so many people can actually overcome this. And it started to work for me in my private practice. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I got to make this information that we know as clinicians, I study interpersonal neurobiology. I've been studying that for a while, but to make this layman, to make this accessible for the everyday man and woman to pick up and read, to start to understand that their behaviors make sense, that they are not crazy. I mean, it's the book I wanted when I was 20. Mm-hmm. Not that facing codependency didn't help me, but it was really attachment. It wasn't codependency. It was really attachment patterns that were impacting me. So there were so many reasons why I wrote this book, and a lot combination of my own suffering, my own healing, and a lot of clients that I helped heal through these patterns, which is a journey. It's a real journey out of your embedded patterns. Mm.
And so that those listening, whether or not maybe they've had the opportunity to read your book or read about this, you could probably speak on this for about 90 minutes, but if you were going to give a brief synopsis, I think there's four most common attachment patterns, but I know there's kind of branches off of those. So how would you, for the listeners, kind of define what those are?
Sure. Yeah. So your attachment patterns, and I love that you're saying styles, because it's not a style, it's a pattern. It's an embedded pattern. Mm-hmm. And it's a pattern that you have in your nervous system that is in combination with somebody else's pattern. So you can show up very differently in different relationships. So even though you might think of yourself as anxious, you might actually show up differently or more avoidant or more secure, depending on the person that you're attaching to. So there are four different categories of different types of patterns, and we can embed all of those inside of us because we take in all of our important relationships. But we'll just say for listeners, there's insecure types and there's secure types. Mm-hmm. And the secure person had a felt sense of safety when they were younger. They got their needs met most of the time, enough of the time, and they go out into the world and they have the ability to actually attract people who probably will meet their needs. Mm-hmm. They have a familiarity that is safer and they don't struggle as much. I'm not going to say they don't struggle in relationship because we all have work to do in relationship, but they have an easier time with closeness. They have an easier time with abandonment. They don't seem to get as activated or as threatened by some of these things. And then we have three insecure types, and they're just kind of patterns in which people learn adaptively to survive. So we have anxious. Mm-hmm. An anxious pattern sometimes can be seen as more of quote unquote codependent, but we'll leave ourselves in order to soothe our parent. And so we can grow up and be very empathic of other people's feelings. We can be people pleasers. We can expand our energy into fight when there's conflict. We are scared of conflict. You know, all those typical abandonment, we're conscious of our abandonment wound. We're sometimes unconscious of our intimacy issues. Mm-hmm. And then there's avoidant, and they grew up with parents that didn't really, a true avoidant, grew up with parents that really didn't see into them emotionally. So they have a little bit less emotional awareness, but they are success driven and they're very productive, and they can struggle with being vulnerable and co-regulating because they didn't get a lot of co-regulation. And sorry, an anxious person struggles with self-regulation because they didn't get a lot of co-regulation. So they'll look to kind of soothe with another person, where an avoidant person gave up on the other person. So they are more likely to move away and try to self-regulate in that way. And then there's fearful, disorganized really is the scientific word. And these, we can have, I have pockets of fearful, and I write about that in my next book. But these are people who struggle with being close and also struggle with being apart. So they really are uncomfortable in relationship. There's a fear of getting too close and there's fear of being alone. So they can feel kind of stuck in their body. And that's a baby that's either been severely neglected, often even abused, because we need to connect as a baby. It's our biological imperative. So if our parent is scary in any way, what we feel in our body is I need to stay in connection and I'm terrified at the same time. So we get stuck in a state like that, and that state kind of, so all of these states and all of these early experiences that we have with our primary caregiver live in our nervous system, live in our neuroception, and they get replayed when we are in close relationships when we're adults. So they get activated or acted out. We'll seek people, we'll feel gravitated towards what's familiar, and we'll unconsciously recreate our childhood dynamics with our adult relationships, which is really what my next book is about, because I find that to be so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I saw that you were halfway through your manuscript. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's been a journey. It's like I thought, because I wrote Anxiously Attached like four times, that this book would be so easy because I have such great support. And it is, I wouldn't say it's easier. I would say it's like having a completely different child. that is complete. It's been slow. I probably won't have to write it that many times. Like, it's just been a completely different experience. So for me to think, oh, I had that experience, so this should be easier. Right. It's not easier or harder. It's just been radically different for me. So, but I'm getting excited because it's coming together slowly but surely.
I'm excited to read it. I feel like they'll have different energy.
I'm listening to the attachment patterns that you're explaining. And I'm wondering, I think I kind of recognize myself in the anxious one. I do have panic disorder. I have CPTSD, and I come from upbringing with a lot of narcissistic abuse. And I'm wondering if you often see the anxious attachment pattern when caregivers were more towards the narcissistic tendencies, or is there another pattern that you think mostly kind of coincides with that kind of upbringing?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that parents with more narcissistic tendencies are going to probably have children with one of the insecure types. Mm-hmm. Depending on those narcissistic tendencies, they're not going to be seen as a whole separate baby, and they're not going to be attended or attuned to in the right way. So the chances of them having a more secure attachment style, an insecure attachment style, is a lot higher. So you could have more disorganized, depending on the level of narcissism and the behaviors in which that parent, if they weren't attuning or they couldn't co-regulate with you or they couldn't see you, you're going to struggle with all of those important developmental stages. You're going to struggle in your relationship. So you're maybe probably more likely to attract a narcissistic partner who has familiar traits of what your parents have. And then you'll relive that familiar hell until you heal some of that. And so that's it's like this unfortunate part of life, unfortunate, but I always feel like we're being called to heal. But unfortunately, we can be in dynamics that don't feel healing. They actually just feel harmful to our brain and our nervous system. And so they wake us up to our earlier wounding. So it's tough to say, like, if you have a narcissistic parent, you're for sure going to be anxious. I definitely think that fear will run through you because you don't have an inherent trust in your primary caregiver. So you're not going to have an inherent trust in relationships.
Something that you said earlier was really important. A lot of what you're saying is, but there was something that really stood out to me, was about how your attachment style can shift and change depending on the relationship you're in. And I'm just kind of self-reflecting a little bit. I think I received very secure attachment from my parents to me, but I don't think my parents were securely attached to each other, which they're now divorced. So, you know, not shocking. Mm-hmm. And what I notice, if I'm unsettled in my nervous system or if I'm stressed and I'm feeling unsafe at all, I can still co-regulate with my children. I kind of never don't feel loving towards them. I can hug them. I can be close with them. But my husband, if I'm not feeling regulated, he is like, get out of the line of fire. So it's like my attachment to him is very different, wildly different than my attachment that I'm able to accomplish with my children and even with just my friends. And so I wonder if you could speak to my specific question. Is there something about if you have past patterns and then you see these patterns playing out currently, how is it that our attachment changes? And is this...
It's not so much that our attachment changes. It's that we have like more of like a kaleidoscope of different attachment experiences stored within us. So certain people can awaken certain patterns and experiences depending on their attachment system. And I you know, as a youngster, if you see your parents in high conflict, that absolutely is going to live inside your system. And I would wonder too, a little bit about your husband and his background, because maybe when you're dysregulated, that is actually cueing his nervous system in a certain way. And so he's avoiding you, and it has more to do with his inability to come closer to you when he's scared. Because you're not in a regulated place. You know what I'm saying? So probably traces back to his family of origin. That would be my guess from the outside, but I would need a lot more information because you have to remember it's really a combination of two people's embedded patterns and how those embedded patterns do a relational dance. And so it's complicated. And yeah, we take in every meaningful relationship in our early years gets taken in. I mean, we actually take these in and we store these memories and embedded patterns inside of us. So, you know, we could look a little bit more at, you know, why you have a safer or more secure attachment with your kids. There's a bigger sense of safety there for you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. So I can blame him. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
I mean, I just work on effective, different communication. Like my nervous system is in this place. What does that mean for your nervous system? Because it's really right. When two nervous systems meet and we telepath fear to each other. So like I could be on a call right now mm-hmm. and whether you tried to or not, if I shifted into sympathetic, if I shifted into a fear state, it could telepath to you. Hey, danger. And that happens automatically and through an unconscious kind of knowing. So sometimes clients can do this to us, but hopefully we stay grounded and our neuroception of safety is pretty big because we're doing our own work. But sometimes in our intimate relationships, we're just telepathing fear back and forth. And that's happening on such an unconscious level. So it's so layered, you know.
Something that, you know, I've kind of thought before is based on, we had a conversation with Bloom Post, who is a shaman and who explained her take on high sensitivity and empaths. And I thought it was a really interesting perspective that you can be born highly sensitive biologically with a more active limbic system because it is genetic and it can be very common in certain bloodlines, but you're made an empath.
Hmm.
And I thought that was really in alignment with what you're saying. Like if you're in a specific environment and you come to your environment with a more sponge-like nervous system already, and you're really picking up the energy and the dynamics and the dances in the room.
Yeah, I mean, I probably would say that, well, for sure, I'm an empath and that has hurt me because but I would probably lean more towards interpersonal neurobiology of understanding it, that as an adaptive strategy, when I was an infant, I had to leave my body. Mm-hmm. I had to literally leave my body and feel into my mother or primary caregiver's body, possibly even regulate them. And so this act of, we can call it self-abandonment, but it's really a brilliant adaptive strategy is I leave my body so I can feel into you so I can survive. Is very prevalent in an anxious person where an avoidant person doesn't leave their body. They can come off as more selfish, but really what they do is they detach from the primary giver and they go into themselves a lot more. And that's where the more selfish type, it's not really, it's self-preservation for them, right? So when you look at adaptive strategies, so sure, there's epigenetics and there's probably DNA, and we're also modeling our mother's brain. So if our mother's more empathic, we're more likely to have that wiring. So there's all these layers as to why we might be more prone to empathic or more prone to, you know, more self on the selfish side. But I would say you know, people who are selfish are suffering too because they're not connecting and not having that ability to be empathic can really hurt them in their lives. But I would say it's more like a combination of your genetics, your mother's brain, and your early, early adaptive strategies. So my early adaptive strategies was I could literally leave my body and be in somebody else's psyche and world as a way to stay safe from what was going on inside of me and as a way to stay close. Because connection is our biological imperative. And that's an adaptive strategy I had to learn to survive that other babies might not have. So I am more prone to that. And so I just think it's so layered and there's probably so many different things. But yeah, I would say that I was in one relationship where I could feel everything he was going through and everything I was going through. It was like so much for me because I'm not even mad at him, even though kind of his behaviors were kind of awful at the end. I mean, really awful, because I know how much he was suffering inside. And I know how much he was suffering inside because I could feel what was going on for him. So it's like, you know, you just have compassion and you have to develop such good boundaries, energetic boundaries in those situations. But my adaptive strategy made me that empathic. That's how I survived. And it can hurt you and it can be helpful depending on the nature of the dynamic that you're in.
Gotcha. That was such a great way of putting that. I've never thought of that before, that anxiously attached babies that grow into adulthood leave their body to join. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's that checking in and that, are we okay? Are you okay? Whereas avoidance, it's not that they're just randomly gone and running. They choose to protect by checking out physically and just leaving the whole situation.
Well, it's actually a sadder, well, disorganized is the saddest, but a true avoidant literally gives up on connection, mm-hmm. you know, and then they don't even know how to reach out for help and co-regulate because they don't have enough of an experience that when I reach out, like an anxious person will sympathetically cry and then get bigger and bigger and bigger and eventually will get attended to. So we'll learn, you know, I can raise my hand and if I scream and shout, eventually someone's going to hear me. Where an avoidant, if the parent can be there physically, but if they're so misattuned and they're not there emotionally, eventually they just give up on that altogether. And they're not even conscious of that. So, and they can deeply desire connection, but they are also terrified of it, or their core wound is no one can really, I can't really count on anyone to be there for me.
Is this, I'm wondering if this example that you're giving, because I'm seeing a lot of similarities in how and what type of person my real dad was and is. Does that type of avoidance also commonly lead to being in adult relationships where you are never quite happy? Like you're always stepping out, you're always looking for that other thing, you know, because like just the amount of affairs and, you know, just, and my feeling about him was always like, he's searching for this something that he can't even describe or understand what it is, but there's this something that always seems to be missing, yet he can never be alone. I mean, the longest he's ever been single was probably a month. Like, he's been married 6 times, you know. And
how many times was he married?
6. And in every one of those, except probably the last one, there was for sure stepping out. And I just kind of feel like I see a lot of connection between what you're saying in the avoidance part and how I witnessed this from the outside.
I'm actually like researching this right now. I wish we were having this conversation a month from now. But so sometimes in the narcissistic wound, there's a need to merge. And then when the merge individuates, there's a sense of separateness and uncomfortability that they look to merge again. Right. So they really do well. They really are looking for the beginning stages of a relationship. There's an infatuation and a sense of like wholeness, aliveness that comes from that stage, but they don't have the interpersonal skills and the development to work through individuation and other stages of the relationship. Mm-hmm. So they'll go out and they'll seek safety in the arms of another woman, AKA mother. Mm-hmm. And that's what that temporarily is, you know, it's that infant kind of looking for that type of connection again. And it's so sad because I too have experienced that. I had a man leave me for another fantasy bond. And I'm like, no, dude, like that doesn't last. Like, you know, and you want those people to like work through it, but it's so painful to live in reality and individuation and in the crux of a real relationship that they must seek out more and more fantasies and they end up hurting so many other people because their adaptive strategy and their belief is, oh, this feels real. This feels new. This feels alive. I must be in love with this person. And it's like, that's a protective layer for them to not face their wound around being like individuating and all that other stuff. So they unconsciously repeat the same. And the person in my life, it's like the same pattern over and over and over again. And it's kind of like, until they heal it, they're going to keep seeking that, and I would say seeking that person or that affair is just a protection from what they don't want to feel without that. Like, so if the relationship starts getting real and we move towards later stages in the relationship, we're actually looking at intimacy, right? We're actually looking at developing intimacy and working through rupture and repair and living in reality together. They don't have the capacity to do that. So they want to jump into another bubble, you know, and that's their way of protecting themselves from the pain that reality might bring for them. And they don't have an ego strength to handle that.
Yeah. And that's very true. Like what you're saying is exactly how it always happened. Like it was always this huge love story, flowers, huge romantic gestures, this ultimate kind of movie type of, you know, everything goes to the wayside, the family, the kids, everything.
And they abandoned everybody. Yeah. They end up abandoning everyone. I mean, being on the other side of that, I've been on the other side of that. I've seen kids on the other side of it. Yeah. It's devastating. It is so devastating. And they're subconsciously living an implicit kind of somatic repeat to try to keep themselves protected from reality. And until they are with the original wound, they will probably keep jumping from next to next to next. It's actually very disorganized to be inside someone like that because they can never get into relationship committed for a while. Then they start to get like they start to back up and then they start to seek out. Right. So like they can't handle calm commitment. They are either in the pursuit of it all. And then once they get it, they're like, now the intimacy is there. So now I'm going to start backing up from it. Usually the woman starts to go crazy, right? Because their energy is being pulled away and then they cheat. Mm. Yeah. Or he or she cheats. I don't want to make this just stereotypical. Because it does really happen on both sides. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I was just saying, I love that fantasy bond. That's like such a good way to describe what that looks like and feels like.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I've been in one of them one time. I mean, you feel like you're on cloud nine. It's wonderful. And then that fantasy becomes your familiar hell pretty soon. You know, that pedestal drops and you're like, holy shit, right? So, you know, I don't know how many people enter that consciously. I don't know how conscious we are, you know? So he's finding other people who have early wounds who want to merge like that. And I think I've learned my lesson. I think once you learn through a process like that, and actually my second book is talking about that, I don't think you repeat it because it's quite painful. Yeah, it's an eye opening, like, oh my God, you know, hopefully you heal it and you don't repeat it. Yeah, that's the hope.
I feel like I've seen this with clients a bit too, where maybe I'm working with the identified client who's not the narcissist, they're in a relationship, the relationship ends, and then the narcissist quickly reestablishes another relationship. And then I'm left supporting the more slightly more anxiously attached normally individual who can't understand why have I not found my person and they have. And it's kind of like we have to slow the train and say, how healthy is that? How good is it that it started that quickly?
Yeah. I mean, I lived through that personally. I mean, someone that I left got married like within, you know, months, and it's kind of like it wrecks your self-esteem. It makes you, I mean, as a clinician, as someone who studies this, I can tell you as a human being, it is still hard. And if you're listening and this has happened to you, their patterns, because they're not healed, are going to repeat again with the next person. And that might not help you in the moment, but your work is to go through this with support and face whatever it is that you are avoiding in that relationship so that you don't repeat the same pattern and attract someone at that developmental level of wounding again. And I always like, I hate the word narcissism, but like if I was in a relationship with one or many, but that means I had early wounding too. And so that wounding needs to be healed. And that's a lot of what I'm working through in this book. And when you do slow down and you do more of the work, you're going to likely, the hope is this isn't that you'll attract someone at a developmental wounding level that's a little bit higher, and then you stand a chance of having a relationship that might have more of the interpersonal development to evolve in a healthy way. So I feel for that. I've been that person that you're just talking about, like, oh my God, I felt like I got hit by a Mack truck. I had PTSD from it. And he just kept driving, right? And never slowed down. Never slowed down. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, I just got ran over. Are you going to acknowledge the insanity that you just put me through? And he's off into the next fantasy. And I can't imagine, there are probably so many people who experience that. And it's like a betrayal. It is a mind F. It is horrible. And you're absolutely right when you say that. That person is going to repeat the same pattern, the same things they did to you, the shutting down, the silent treatment, or whatever it is. those learned behaviors are going to be now just projected onto the next person. And you have this chance to heal, and healing isn't fun, but it can create a change for you and eventually get you to a relationship that will actually meet more of your needs. And hopefully you'll be have a little more longevity and happiness and all of that in it.
I'm interested in how you're saying that it means that you had wounds too, because I definitely see that in my own life. My first two serious relationships were very much in terms of they were abusive. It was very much the same as where I came from. I definitely had a lot of healing to do. And then when I met my husband, thank goodness I met him. I was definitely not ready to meet him. I was not on any kind of healing path. And that first 2 years of our marriage was really tough, because I was almost the one that I would say was not behaving well, because it was like I was feeling insecure that everything was so regulated and calm and a clean and a beautiful and a loving environment, that I sought out a lot of the arguments, like, but why aren't you fighting with me? You know, like, why aren't you angry about this? And he was, thank goodness, he knew my history and where I came from. And he was just there for that. And he was just always saying, like, I know what's happening here in the background. I'm just going to stay calm. Like, I know why you're freaking out. I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying. And it took me a long time to get over that kind of feeling like this is not a roller coaster. This is a calm, good, healthy environment. So I definitely relate a lot to what you're saying in terms of you also go into it wounded, because you kind of attract these relationships because that's all you know.
Yeah. So you're a great example. And there's so many paths. Like, my path was to spend some time single to work the pattern out of me and face some of my own loneliness. But sometimes we can attract someone who's more secure than us. Like, so we're all different levels. I think, like, maybe my past was here and I was here and I could see it, but I couldn't get him to come here. And it sounds like you were here and you attracted someone who was here, who eventually slowly, but you had to go through the cycles and the regular behaviors and work them out to get to a place where you're like, oh, okay, I can be here. Yeah. So our nervous system is still going to cycle. It's still going to mistake intensity for love. And if we don't have that type of intensity, we might be like, oh my God, we're left with this boredom or this space. And this feels really uncomfortable and a lot. So there's so many paths to working with our nervous system, and a healthy, secure person who's more secure than you can definitely impact you in a positive way. I mean, that's the hope. If you're listening and you don't have a secure partner, that's when I say you start to build secure relationships with your therapist. You start to find secure friendships. You start to get your nervous system to understand what attunement and security and rupture and repair really feel like. That, not that it needs to be calm, but that when conflict comes up, there's enough interpersonal skills to rupture and repair and deepen in your relationship. So many paths to it. And that's amazing that you have someone that you brought in, that brought into your world and got you kind of to work, to realize that those things kind of worked out of you.
I love that you said boredom, because I feel like that's something that not only do I hear a lot of my clients talk about, but it is something that I brought up very early on in my relationship, to the point where it was actually in our wedding vows.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yes. That he was going to, you know, make sure that we didn't fall into a pattern of boredom. I don't remember. It was very poetic the way it was said. But how do we work through that? Because I feel like that need to ignite an interpersonal, you know, relationship or a romantic relationship, I feel like that's something so many people can relate to. And maybe I'm just curious personally, because that's something that when you said that, I'm like, yes, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, so when things are, well, I think a lot of this can happen unconsciously. So we could pick fights and not realizing that we're struggling with a ventral state, or we're struggling with the space that comes up when there isn't conflict. And so how do we handle space? How do we handle what comes up inside our body when we're not being, you know, engaged in a certain way? And so, and our need, like, I remember I was separating from someone one time and my life was like so still. I was like, I think I might send him an email. And my therapist was like, do you think maybe you're reaching out to him because your life is just so still right now and you're so used to like some kind of engagement? And I was like, oh my God, she's so smart. Yeah, mm-hmm. She's so right. I don't need to be reaching out to him. I need to be with a part of me that struggles when there's no one here messing with me or interaction, you know, like, so I think it's getting really curious as to what does it feel like when I don't have that? What does it feel like when their boredom exists? What surfaces inside of me? What might I be avoiding, you know, and getting conscious of it? How am I using this fighting as a way to connect, right? Like sometimes it's our way to connect is to create a fight. And was that in my childhood home? Who did I learn that pattern from? So it's just, it's getting curious around that because connection, even through fighting, sometimes is better than like nothing, you know, mm-hmm. For a lot of babies interacting or even being abused is better than not existing. Yeah. Right. So, you know, kind of just getting curious of like, there's so much space here. What is it bringing up for me? And, you know, am I creating negative kind of scenarios to try to get myself kind of out of the space of the void or this, you know, whatever that is. So I've just a lot of self-reflecting there. If you can catch yourself. I mean, my therapist caught me and I did not send this man an email, but I was like, she's right. I want to engage because it does something to me. And it's, I'm living with months of silence and, you know, we want to be called out on our stuff sometimes too.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. You've used the word heal a lot in our conversation today. And I know that can mean many different things for different people. I'm curious in your mind, if you were supporting or guiding someone towards that healing process, towards secure attachment, mm-hmm. Are there any actionable things? I've heard you say a few things like self-reflecting and checking in with secure attachments that you might have like a therapist. I mean, what would be the most important things in your mind for people to do to work towards healing and to work towards secure attachment?
I think the most important thing, and this is a big message, is that healing does not mean that you're fixing or avoiding your inner pain. It means that you're actually feeling it in the accompaniment of people who could help support you feel it. So people are like, I'm coming to therapy to feel worse. Yeah, you are. You're coming to therapy to feel what's in your body because it got stored in there with the accompaniment of someone whose nervous system is present and caring so we can re-experience this crap together, right? So we can move it out of your body up into your right hemisphere and eventually into your left. So I think the big misconception, and you have to meet every client. I have one client in particular who doesn't want to feel into his body. So you stay with all the protectors, right? Mm-hmm. And then other clients, like I run a core wound group where everybody's dropping into their body and they're fine. And like, I'm like on the feeling in your gut right now, like that is memory. We talk a lot about memory. So I think in our culture, a lot of people think healing is like this portal of bliss and I won't feel pain anymore. When actually healing is going into the density in your body, kind of allowing yourself to feel what you might not have felt before, connecting it to the root, and eventually it does move, but it's a courageous practice. It's moving into your suffering with support. It's not what a lot of people think, like, let's go to therapy to fix myself. It's like, let's go to therapy to embody your experience and start to integrate these parts so that you don't have to live a life unconsciously avoiding things. So you don't have to live a small life. So you don't have to keep repeating these patterns. So you can start to understand what is at the core of these patterns. So healing means feeling. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us are, you know, feeling adverse because we didn't have parents that would help navigate us through our feelings. So it's new territory. It was new territory for me. Healing. I'm on a healing path. I've been with the same person for like 4 years, the same therapist, you know, and I'm on the other side of it, but it never ends. Mm-hmm. You just kind of get past some of the harder stuff. At least you think you do. Mm-hmm. And then I would say healing, when you're in it, if you're really working with someone and if you're listening, you know, someone who works with your body, someone who's actually kind of go there. I think, you know, we all need different type of therapy and coaches, but I think to heal attachment wounds, you must go to the body because they were created so early that you need a therapist that has that kind of awareness. And I also feel like when I was in the midst of my really awful healing, I had such a great therapist that I knew, and I'm explaining the science in the next book because it helped me stay on track. But I knew I was in the process. Like I could feel myself, it was horrible and it was hard and it was a lot of work, but I knew I was in this process. And so I was able to kind of stay in the process, in the trust of the process. More. And I'm a therapist who studies this for a living. So it's very hard to get the regular person or standard person to trust, like, oh my God, I'm going to go to therapy. And sometimes it's just not going to feel good, you know?
Right.
It's a journey. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know I once called a therapy kind of like getting a nose job. Like you go in, they break it, they fix it up, but you're really bruised and in pain.
Yeah.
But it ends up being really beautiful in the end.
Right. So, right. Yeah, it does. There's a beauty and a deepening of meaning in life and a connection to yourself and others. And, you know, and I think as someone who suffered early attachment wounds, now I have the ability to have so many wonderful attachments to so many people. Like my world is expansive now rather than limited. Those early wounds make our world so small. Mm-hmm. And then I think when we heal, we start to expand and we have all these wonderful relationships because we start to feel more secure. And it's a very different feeling than I'm in this primary relationship and I have to keep it like this tight. And I don't have the energy or the safety to really connect to many people. It's a smaller world, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, I think of secure attachment as you encourage each other to expand and have those big lives and try new things and step away knowing the person will always be there rooting you on for whatever those exciting things you want to learn or do. Or it doesn't always mean total togetherness. It can mean, you know, admiring the person that you're in connection with from the sidelines as they become who they are. So,
yeah. And I'm helping people, like in my next book, I call it anchors, like finding many people to securely attach to is not so easy for someone in early attachment, but like having several anchors support you so you're not dependent on one.
I love that so much.
Which is not how we're biologically designed when we have early wounds. We're looking for the one, right? But like shifting that to actually many people can hold me right now. Then you internalize those people. And that's what a baby does. They internalize secure parents. So as an adult, we're internalizing secure anchors. And then we feel them with us even when we're not around them, which is the way a secure baby feels around their parents. Mm-hmm. So it's all very interesting how we can recreate that as an adult and really heal it.
You know what I love about that too? When I think about working with people who have entered into unhealthy or abusive relationships, one of the most common scary patterns is when someone tries to isolate you and, from what you're saying, pull you from your anchors. So that's a red flag. If someone is pulling you from your anchors because of their insecurity or narcissism or whatever their motivation is, that is not a good sign. And so I love, like, thank you for such good visuals of how to describe this.
And they might not even be like verbally or covertly telling you, you know, sometimes they are, but they might create such instability within the dynamic with you that you don't feel safe enough in your body to go out and explore the world. So you have to stay close to them because it doesn't feel safe.
Yes. That's such a good way of putting that. It's not always so obvious.
Yeah.
So you mentioned your new book, and I was curious if you wanted to tell our listeners a little bit about it. I don't know how much you can share, and also where they can just find you and learn more about these amazing resources you have out in the world for everyone.
Sure. Well, if you haven't read my first book, it's doing so well out there, and it's really great. But I am working on my second manuscript. It's called Safe: Coming Home to Yourself and Others. It's an attachment-informed guide to healing, healing your attachment wounds, but building more secure relationships. And it walks you through the healing process of attachment wounds and getting out of the styles and starting to understand the patterns and starting to understand like a fuller picture and getting you like anxiously attached, there's a lot of somatic body work within in the copy of the book that I encourage you to take to your anchors, whether it's therapists or people, because the earlier the wound, the more we need that kind of witnessing on the other side. So it's 9 chapters. I'm on chapter 6 right now. I am feeling pretty good about it. It's due in November, the middle of November, but I have till December 1st, my agent said. Mm-hmm. And I think I'll be done on time. But it won't hit print till next fall or winter. So fall of 2020. It takes a long time, a year to write, a year to print any kind of traditional book. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's very exciting. And if you find me online, my Instagram is Jessica Baum, LMHC. On my websites, any of them, there's a link to sign up for my email list. And I will let people know when this new book comes out. And I have online courses. I do live courses every once in a while. They're a very small container of people to do, at least start this work with. And then I have a team of people, therapists and coaches that work with me and work on attachment issues. And everybody on my team knows about this stuff and works with it, but they also have like their unique gifts and styles and approaches.
Mm-hmm. So excited about your book coming out. Maybe you'll have to come back next fall and tell us all about it. And
I would love to,
share it with the masses. So.
Yeah, yeah. Cannot wait until I'm like, here's the manuscript and I hand it over, you know, and then there's another level of editing, but you're kind of like at that, but I got to enjoy the process that I'm in right now.
You could like wrap it in holiday paper and like,
exactly.
Happy holidays.
Yeah.